Disapproval. You're in the middle of a conversation and someone asks you for something you don't want to give. Maybe your body tenses, your jaw sets, and your mouth opens up, and before you know it, you've said yes. Your brain hasn't even caught up yet. By the time you've left the room, maybe you're already resenting them and yourself. That's not people-pleasing. That's a nervous system response with a name. I'm Marie Vakarkas, accredited mental health social worker and couples therapist, and welcome to This Complex Life. Today, I'm talking about the fawn response, why so many of us can't say no, where this pattern comes from, and the first things to try when you notice yourself doing it. The term fawn response was introduced a little while ago by a psychotherapist called Pete Walker in around 2003. He was working a lot in the PTSD space and in codependency and noticed this additional response that people had that didn't quite fit into the fight, flight or freeze responses that we already knew about. He laid it out in more detail in a book in 2013. Called Complex PTSD, From Surviving to Thriving. Now, he wasn't inventing this idea of the fawn response. It actually has been observed in the animal kingdom across mammals for a long time, since the 50s. But what Walker did was able to take something that was an older concept and apply it clinically to treating people with complex trauma and place it alongside the fight, flight or freeze response as a distinct response pattern. And then when we look at polyvagal theory and Stephen Porges' work, we start to see more layers here. Appeasing is not just a physiological strategy, it's an automatic nervous system driven process of co-regulation. Your body is trying to regulate the other person's state to make you safer. It is an attempt to create safety. The thing I want you to understand about this is not just a pop psychology concept. There is an underlying response here that is driven by decades of research that we're learning more and more about. And when we can name it and recognize it, it can give people a language for their experience and start to find new ways to communicate or to be in relationship without fawning and without losing themselves in that process. So the fawn response, what the fawn response actually is. Now, most people have heard of fight or flight, and some have heard of fight, flight or freeze, but very few have heard of fawn. So let me explain them all to you. The fight response, that's to confront, to argue, to push. Flight is to run away, to exit, to avoid, to withdraw. Freeze is shut down, go blank, maybe can't speak. Fawn is appease and smooth over, agree, make it okay for the other person at the cost of yourself. It's not a personality flaw. It's a nervous system response. And it's done so quickly that your body is reacting before your brain has even had a chance to catch up. In polyvagal terms, your social engagement system is working in overdrive. You're reading micro cues in the other person, in their face, in their tone, in their posture, and you're shaping yourself to their state, all in a split second, all before conscious awareness. It doesn't look like trauma from the outside. It looks like someone being nice, being flexible, easy to get along with. And that pattern is invisible precisely because it's socially rewarding. There's a lot of benefit to this response, to being the one who comes across as easygoing and super flexible and the nice person, the nice guy, the nice lady, the super chilled, relaxed person. So it can be really confronting to think about changing that because you think, what am I giving up? Well, I like being the nice person. And I'm going to talk about the distinction between being nice and fawning a little bit later. How this shows up in day-to-day life is varied. What I see in the therapy room is a mixed bag. For some people, it's apologizing for things that wasn't their fault and it happened so quickly. Someone bumps into the supermarket and you say sorry. If someone's in a bad mood, you're apologizing for something you didn't do. And on the other side, for people around them, that can be quite irritating. It can be quite annoying. It can be really infuriating, frustrating, or some people can take advantage of that. So one of the ways it shows up is constant apologizing for things that aren't your. Another way it shows up is abandoning your own opinion mid-conversation. So you might have an opinion about something and then someone else has a contradictory one or has some differences there, and midway through you might turn that conversation around and be like, yeah, actually, you're right, that's what I meant to, and just agreeing with their perspective. It could be agreeing with people that you fundamentally disagree with just to keep the peace. That could be at work, at family dinners, in conversations with friends. It shows up in a number of ways, and this is very different to being boundaried and choosing the right time and place for different conversations. It can be really tricky to explain to some people what this difference looks like, but you notice it afterwards. You'll notice afterwards you feel that you've lost a part of yourself, or maybe after several weeks or months you feel inauthentic, or people don't really know you, or resentful, like, why am I doing XYZ for other people and it never comes my way? If you're starting to notice those things, and it's more likely fawning rather than a specifically chosen strategy for a certain environment to have a harmonious conversation. I know there would be some conversations at the dinner table that I would avoid, and it's not a fawn response. It's because I know that's not going to give us a good family dinner or a good barbecue or a good dinner party. And so it's not a fawn response as much as a let's redirect the conversation to something a little more conducive to a good time. And one of the other ways it shows up is in kind of like a shape shifting. So sort of being one way in one room and one way in another, slightly adjusting personalities, different views, slightly different energy. Over time, this can be really disorienting where you don't know who you are anymore. We can also see some people feeling like they're responsible for other people's emotional states. And so if someone, maybe your boss or your partner, is sad or upset, you find yourself trying to like lift them up and be all jokey and maybe like poke them and prod them. Maybe you wouldn't be doing this to your boss, but to your partner. So you're trying to put them in a better mood because a part of you feels responsible for that, or seeing someone in a bad mood meant it was unsafe, that something unsafe was going to follow. So if your mum is stressed, you absorb it. If your boss is cranky, you absorb it. And sometimes you find it, you feel like it's your responsibility to fix that or change. Another way I see it, and this is probably the most common in couples therapy, is what I call, well, what's called checking behaviors. It's like, are you okay? Are we okay? Are things okay? Is this okay? And constantly scanning for whether the other person is pleased and okay. And all of these can be really harmful to relationships because they can feel inauthentic. It can actually be a version of lying. Fawning is lying in a way. And that kind of dishonesty can really rupture relationships. And when the other people start to respond with maybe being a bit more short or distant, it actually increases the fawn response. So in that last example, if someone is checking, are we okay, or are we all good? And let's say that was me and I'm asking my partner, are we okay? Is everything okay? Have I done something to upset you? And they're like, fine, Marie, just stop it. Then I would think, oh my God, they're upset. See, I was right. Something's wrong. Oh my God, have I done something to upset you? What should I do? And the more I start to fawn, the more maybe irritable they get, the more maybe short they are with me, or they might snap back with something. And then that cycle just constantly repeats itself. And that can lead into more of an attachment style pattern there. And I'm going to do another episode on attachment styles very soon. Let's keep an eye out for that. But you can see how that pattern can emerge really quickly, that if someone's always checking in, are we okay? Is everything okay? Is everything fine? Are we good? That it actually makes it hard for people to be direct and clear with them because they don't know how. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about how we have those conversations later in the episode. So how this can look, and you might not notice it straight away, but say that you've got a friend who says, hey, can you look after my dog? And you say, yeah, sure, no problem. And before you realize, you're like, I don't even like dogs. I had plans this weekend. And so your dog gets dropped off and he's like, this is so great, I'm so looking forward to it. And then they leave and you're thinking, oh my gosh, what have I done? I have got this furball in my house and I had plans, and they're a little bit annoying, and maybe they chew the bottoms of chairs, and so I'm going to be so annoyed because they've ruined that. And the friends message you saying, is everything good? You're like, yeah, it's fine, but slowly getting resentful. And then maybe you start thinking to yourself, why did she bother asking me? Why does she always just assume I'm going to do this? When I ask for a favor, favor, nobody ever says yes. So when you're starting to see those resentments coming up, that's a sign that you are fawning and not sticking to your boundary. And it actually erodes trust. When you say no to something, your yes has much more value. And I know it's super hard to think about saying no to something because that person might be upset or disappointed. And that's a distinction that you need to start to learn, is uncomfortable doesn't mean unsafe. Uncomfortable doesn't mean unsafe. And you can be uncomfortable when someone is disappointed that you've said, no, I can't look after your dog today. And the relationship can stay intact. And in fact, usually over time, when you say no, and then you actually say yes, because you can, that yes has more power and trust builds. And so learning to understand the difference between discomfort and safety are going to be huge in trying to manage the fawn response. So why this gets mistaken for being a good person? From the outside, fawning can be indistinguishable from kindness. People pleaser, being genuinely warm, they can look identical in a single interaction, but there is a difference. Culturally, we reward fawning. The easy colleague, the low maintenance friend, the accommodating partner. There are social prizes or social reward for this kind of behavior. And women get rewarded more heavily for it than men. Being agreeable is often reinforced as being feminine, being a good girl or being nice. And so there's a cultural pattern on top of the nervous system one. And fawners, sadly in a way, are often praised their whole lives for that exact response, for that trait that is actually slowly hurting them. Oh, she's so easy to be around. He's so thoughtful. She's the one that's so easygoing. You know, that praise is a trap, and it can leave someone feeling unable to get their needs met. It can leave relationships being inauthentic. It can lead to a buildup of resentment. And for a lot of people that I see in my therapy room, they feel like they fit in but not belong, that they can kind of get through interactions and conversations, but no one really knows them and no one shows up for them. And that it's not an instant response necessarily. It happens gradually over time. It's like it slowly gets chipped away at. And there is a cost to that invisible trait. You can't fix what you can't see. And most people are carrying around this pattern and they don't even know that they do it or that they have it. They just know that they're tired and they're resentful and they can't quite work out why. So fawning gets rewarded. The obvious question here is, does it start in the first place? For most people, it starts early in childhood. It comes often in childhood environments where other people's emotions felt emotionally dangerous. And it's often negative emotions. We rarely find someone's joy or happiness or enthusiasm dangerous, right? It's usually their frustration, their anger, their anxiety, maybe their depression, maybe if they had substance use and they came home drunk. So we might be finding their certain emotions as potentially dangerous, that a fight might erupt, that they might get violent, belittle us, put us down, speak to someone else poorly. We might observe this in a parent or in a sibling and think, well, I've learned a way to try and circumvent that, to prevent that from happening. It doesn't always need to be physical danger, but that is a huge factor as well. And more often, it's when you've got a parent whose anger or disappointment felt catastrophic, even if nothing physical happened. And when you're little, your parents are huge influences in your life. They're superheroes to us. And so to feel like that relationship, that connection could be threatened at any point, literally feels like a life or death scenario. And so we learn ways to maneuver around that. So if their disappointment felt threatening, we're going to try really hard not to disappoint them. And then we carry those patterns into adulthood. It can also be present in environments where love felt conditioned, where affection and warmth, approval felt earned through being agreeable rather than freely given. So maybe you got a lot of attention and affection and praise when you were being a good girl, and then things got withdrawn if you were seen as being difficult or not agreeable. Families, in fact, this can also show up in families where disagreement is seen as disloyal, where having a different opinion got you labeled as the problem child, the difficult one, or the selfish one. I've seen this show up quite a bit recently for some reason in some of the people that I work with, where some people don't even know how to ask for what they need as adults. I don't even know what restaurant to suggest with their friends because they never felt that they had a say, that if they said, hey, I want pizza and someone else in the family wanted Thai, that it was like, why would you want that? That's stupid. And so I better not say the wrong thing. And that instinct has been brought into adult relationships where someone might say, hey, where do you want to go for dinner on a Friday night? They're like, oh, I don't mind, whatever you want. And it's not because they're genuinely indifferent and they're like, oh, I could eat anything. They're scared of getting it wrong and they're scared of saying the wrong thing. That what if I say pizza and the other person is gluten intolerant and they're going to get offended and say that they can't come or that's a stupid place? Or what if I pick something that turns out to be really bad and I get yelled at? And all of these thoughts are surrounding that. It's not just about, I really don't mind whatever we want. That's when it starts to be a fawn response rather than easygoing. If it's something like, for me, if a friend says, when do you want to go for dinner? I was like, actually, I don't mind. I'm happy if you do pick something. I like trying something new. I genuinely like trying something new. And if it's a crappy restaurant, we'll laugh about it together. If there's some dietary preferences that I have, I might say, I'm happy to do anything other than pizza. Do you want to pick something close to you? And we have a conversation about it. It's different to being a fawn response. So there is a slight difference. It's not in the words that you say. So someone from the outside might not know the difference. It's only in knowing how it feels for you. And that's the really difficult bit. So when I'm working with someone in a therapy room, we're trying to look at the effect that it has on the person rather than what the people around them might see. And so when you're questioning, shouldn't, am I going to get in trouble? Am I going to get it wrong? What if I do this? And that's a fawn response. Okay. So you can start to see the difference there. For other people, this emerges when you've had households that have big emotions and there's not a lot of space for yours. Maybe there was an unwell parent, someone struggling with their own mental health, maybe a volatile parent, a very critical parent. The child learns to scan and adjust constantly and then adapt to that accordingly. Sometimes it comes from generational patterns. A parent who fawned, who modeled it, who couldn't tolerate their own child having a different inner world, that might get repeated. And so there's so many ways that this can show up and be created. And why fawning? Why fawning rather than fight or flight? Sometimes a child has no option to, they'd lose. They're little. They have no option to flee. Where would they go? So fawning is a very available strategy for children. It worked. That de-escalation worked. The tension lifted, saying, yep, cool, Thai food's fine with me. When you really want pizza, as long as you can tolerate the food, you're just going to think that was worth it. I don't want to start a fight. Okay, the nervous system files this away as, oh, good strategy. This worked. Fight avoided. Check. We're going to do that again. And so that strategy kept them safe. And so it keeps going. So let's think of, I want to share an example now where somebody has a parent with some serious mental health issues. And even though the parent was doing the best they could with what they've got, this person learned a little bit to not have as many needs, to not ask for things. And so they didn't want to ask for anything for a treat, or if they asked for a particular present at Christmas time, it might have been seen as too expensive. And their parents had made comments about not being able to afford it. So they learned to just not say what they wanted. When it came to talking about school or how their day was, they never said anything disagreeable. Everything was, yep, okay, that's fine. What sports do you want to play? Your brother's doing this. Do you want to do the same thing? Yep, sure. And so they sacrifice little bits of themselves over time. As an adult, that might show up with someone not even knowing what they like. They don't even know where to start. You might ask them, do you feel Thai or pizza? And they genuinely don't know. They have been so conditioned to look at how you will respond or how people around them will respond to their response that they haven't even considered what I might like. And so that can be really confronting. And it can also be very difficult for the people around them to not know what that person authentically likes, what would bring them joy, what would bring them pleasure, what would be fun or exciting or interesting to them. What's their identity? Because they might keep changing it. They might like one thing with one person, like one thing with another, be okay with this, be okay with that, and they don't even know who they are anymore. And it's useful to start to picture and understand what this could be like for those people. And if this is you, starting to recognize those traits in yourself is the first step to learning how to do it different. And to be really kind with yourself and to have empathy, that's a strategy that you learned to keep you safe. Like, how cool is that? Our brains and our bodies do some really remarkable things to keep us safe. And in adult life, sometimes those tools that we developed aren't super useful and can actually be sabotaging. And so it's come from a good place, and we might need to add a few new things in there so that we can be our most authentic self and not feel that resentment and not lose who we are. Okay, so what's the point? What's it actually costing you? Isn't it really great to just be nice? Well, yeah. And that's fine. You can still be a nice person. When it's fawning, what happens is your needs never get met because you don't name them. Over time, this can build up into low-level chronic resentment. Not the loud kind. I mean, it can be that. Like sometimes you can say something instantly and think, oh, I wish I didn't do that. But it can be the quiet, seething type that changes how you feel about the people you love. Maybe you start to feel like, well, nobody really knows me. They don't understand me. They don't show up for me. I'm sick and nobody's there with chicken soup. I would do this for someone else. So then you start jumping to conclusions around, well, I do this because I care. If they don't do this, then hence they don't care about me. And so it can create these negative loops in our minds around people's affection for us or people's care. You lose an idea of what you actually want. You might not have even known. After years of calibrating to other people, the question of what do you feel like for dinner can feel genuinely unanswerable. There is a physical cost too. Chronic fawning keeps your nervous system in a low-grade stress state. It could be a tight jaw, could be shallow breath, could be a shortened fuse, and it could be tiredness that sleep doesn't fix. So it's a low-level constant sort of on, like maybe a little bit of a buzzing, or you never quite feel entirely relaxed. You can lose touch with your own preferences, your own opinions, own taste, even your own emotional response. And some clients I see describe it as, I don't even know who I am anymore. I'm like this with this group. I'm like this with this group. I'm like this at work, but I don't know who me really is. And fawning, I hate to tell you this, it actually creates distance, not closeness. I know you're going to think, no, but I keep people close and I keep them pleased and I couldn't handle it. I mean, I'm a nice person and I'm easygoing. And when it's fawning, it creates distance, not closeness. That's the counterintuitive piece. It feels like closeness because you're accommodating, but genuine intimacy requires two people to show up. If one of you is always agreeing, always accommodating, always disappearing in what the other person needs, the other person is in a relationship with a mirror. And mirrors don't make you feel close to someone. Mirrors make you feel lonely. And when I work with couples where one partner fawns, the partners of them often say things like, I don't really know you. You don't share your inner world with me. I feel lonely when we're together. I don't know what you actually think. They're wanting connection. They're wanting a difference of opinion. They're wanting to know what you actually think, what you feel, what you want, what you desire, what makes you happy. And when they don't get that, they feel disconnected. Intimacy requires difference. It requires you saying, I see things differently, or that doesn't work for me. What you did hurt my feelings, and the relationship is still intact. Fawning removes all of that, and it actually removes the very thing that closeness is built on. So what do you actually do about it? This is where I want you to start. Noticing first. You don't have to change anything. If you're listening to this and you're thinking, oh, God, this is me, I'm so glad that you've recognized that. That's a huge first step. The first step isn't to stop fawning, it's to see it happening. Notice the physical cue first. Maybe your jaw tenses, maybe your stomach drops, maybe your breathing changes, you get really shallow or hold your breath, and there's an urge to apologize or change the subject. That's the fawn response. It lives in the body before it's even entered the mind. It can be super, super quick. And it shows up as a sensation first. So try to notice those sensations. Buy some time. So one of the strategies I try and get my clients to do is to create even a pause. Okay, so 5 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I mean, that's excruciating for some people, but take a moment, take a breath, and try a response like, let me check and get back to you. Okay, so if your friend rings and they want you to puppy sit and you're thinking, heck no, I don't want that dog chewing the bottom of my wooden chair and pooping on my rug, just not in the mood for dealing with a puppy, don't say, sure, that'd be great. let me check and get back to you. Buy yourself some time. Let me confirm with my partner, or let me check my diary. Let me see what else I have on. Okay, so try and buy some time first. That's the single most useful phrase a fawner can use. Let me check and get back to you. And if it's a text message, well, you don't have to respond straight away. So you can actually just wait a little bit. If you need more time, like depending on how urgent the response is required, like if it's Friday lunchtime and someone's saying, "Hey, can you help us out Friday, tonight? Let me get back to you," might be within a half hour or an hour. For other bigger things, it could be a 24-hour window that you've got. Let me get back to you tomorrow, or let me get back to you by the end of the week. So allowing some time, and you have to get back to them. You can't just avoid this. You actually have to get back to them. But the first thing I want you to try is buying some time. Tolerating that discomfort is so important. So learning to tolerate the discomfort of displeasing someone. I'll talk about this a lot more in an episode I'm going to do on boundaries. I'm actually going to do a whole series about boundaries. And so if you've got some questions more around implementing boundaries, let me know. You can email me, you can fill out a confidential form. There's a whole bunch of ways I want to hear from you, but we're not going to talk about that right now. But you have to learn to tolerate the discomfort that comes with disappointing someone. And that is the real work. That is being okay with them being like, "Oh no, but I was really hoping you could look after the puppy and you've done it before." It's like, "I understand, I still can't." And clear is kind here. You can be kind and be clear. But if that seems too hard, start with buying some time first. Disappointing someone is not abandoning them. Saying no is not cruel. That guilt you feel when holding a small boundary is not evidence that you did the wrong thing. Remember, there's a difference between discomfort and something being unsafe. And learning the difference between me saying no and that feeling awkward or uncomfortable doesn't mean that that relationship is under threat, and it doesn't mean that that was an unsafe interaction. And I think we can confuse that. We can think all discomfort means something is unsafe and something is bad, and we can avoid or fawn or freeze or fight, you know, all of those responses. So trying to recognize that it's supposed to be a little bit uncomfortable because someone could be disappointed, and that's okay. You don't have to fix it. They can tolerate or learn to tolerate their own disappointment, and that's not on you. So if you want to try something different, start with some low stakes moments. Don't start with the most difficult conversation of your life. Small things. When someone asks you, "Where do you want to eat?" say something different. Like try. Instead of saying, "Oh, wherever you want," saying, "I wouldn't mind some Japanese food. Actually, there's a few places in the city that I'd like to check out. I saw this review in Broadsheet. Could we check it out? The pub near me does a really nice parma. Could we go there? It's close to work." Actually having a preference. And if this is a question that you anticipate, have some go-to places ready. Do some Googling, figure out what you like, what your budget is, what's around you or around work or wherever it is that you go. So the next time someone says, "Where do you want to go for dinner?" you have some places ready to recommend. I want you then to think about when you get invited to stuff. So think about, do you actually want to go to that concert, to see that movie, to go to that show? And have a think about it. Does it match what you're interested in? Is it maybe an issue around finances? Like, can you afford it? Or maybe you're just not into musicals. And so actually saying, "I'd love to hang out with you. I'm not really interested in seeing that musical. I can meet you afterwards for a drink, or I can meet you earlier. We can have dinner and then you can go with the other people to the show." Or, "That sounds great. Thanks for thinking of me. Not my thing. Is there anything else you want to do?" So being okay with knocking that back and thinking about, do I actually want to do this? And it could be that it's too expensive, you don't like it. Maybe it's on a weeknight and that's just not going to work for you because you get tired midweek. Or it's on a weekend where you've got a lot of other things on. Being able to reflect on that and have a response ready to go is going to be really helpful. And the third is thinking about TV shows and movies. So next time a friend or a partner or a housemate says, "Do you want to watch this?" And instead of saying, "Sure," and just being happy that they're connecting with you, saying, "That's not really my thing," or "Let's find something we both like," or "No, I don't feel like watching that tonight." So practice with some low stakes environments, some low stakes examples. Practicing small, honest conversations will feel hard. The nervous system needs to start to learn a new way of responding to disagreement. Each time you let yourself be real and be authentic and your body sees nothing catastrophic happens, you teach your body a new pattern. It takes time. Think of it like rebuilding fitness. it's not just flipping a switch. You can't just go from not running to suddenly running. You start small. You might do 60 seconds of running and be pooped, or maybe you can do 1 kilometer or 2 kilometers. But if you've not run before, it's going to be a lot harder, and you might need to start with smaller increments, and you might be able to tolerate less than other people or different amounts to other people. And so learning to push through the discomfort, running's a really good example. When we think about fitness, we think about it might be uncomfortable. It's not going to feel great. We might be a bit stiff and sore the next day, and we're finding the right way to push ourselves to grow, because we do require some discomfort to build fitness, but we don't want to run through so much pain that we cause an injury. We don't want to be running to the point where we're having stress fractures and shin splints and having so much pain that it's because of an injury. So finding that balance for mental health, for communication skills, is really important as well. It's going to be hard. It's going to be awkward. And you might be your own version of, you know, puffed out because you haven't done it before. And over time, it gets easier with practice. Practice makes progress, not perfection. Practice makes progress. So keep practicing those low stakes environments. So this work, if you're struggling to do this on your own, and it might be really hard, it's really important to find a trauma-informed therapist that can help you shift these patterns and understand what's genuinely underneath them, and recognizing what purpose they've served, what purpose this response has served, and what it's costing you, and how to do it differently. Now, I want to answer some questions that I get most about this topic. They come up in my counseling room. I've seen them on Reddit threads. I've seen it in Instagram reels, in the comment sections. I've pulled together a bunch of questions that I thought would be really helpful to answer for this episode. Is fawning the same as people pleasing? Now, this is a really common question, and the answer, there's a distinction. People pleasing is a behavior that you can see from the outside, saying yes, going along with things, being accommodating, smoothing things over. But fawning is the nervous system mechanism underneath. It's actually what's driving the behavior. Not all people pleasing is fawning. Sometimes you are genuinely thoughtful, generous, or it could be strategic. It becomes fawning when it's compulsive, automatic, and anxiety driven. So from the outside to other people, they might not be different. The only way to know the difference is what's happening for you internally. When the yes is out of your mouth before you've even thought about it, when you find it impossible to say no, then it's fawning. And it matters because fawning is a nervous system response that needs a different type of work to adjust and to learn, and it costs you something different. And people pleasing, I mean, it can still be quite an anxious trait. It can still be linked to trying to make other people happy, but I'm really focusing on the fawn response here. Second question, is fawning always a trauma response? No, not always. And I know I started off by saying there are 4 trauma responses, fight, flight, freeze, and fawn, but it's not always a trauma response. Genuine kindness exists. Genuine generosity exists. And being a thoughtful person isn't a pathology. The difference is whether it feels chosen or it's a compulsion. If you've waited up and you've said yes and you're okay about it afterwards, awesome, great. If you're body says yes before your brain has caught up, and afterwards you feel depleted, resentful, or confused about why you agree, then it's fawning. And it's not always trauma. It can be certain environments, like I mentioned earlier, childhood experiences, certain family structures that weren't traumatic, but they didn't allow for us to develop a capacity to say no easily. That fawning meant keeping the peace. And that danger could have been violence. It could have been physical harm. It could have been severe neglect or abuse. And for some people, it could have been an unhelpful response. But when you're little and you're really dependent on your family, literally for life or death, it can really shape these behaviors. So it's not always about trauma, but we put it into that category of a trauma response. And if you're still not sure if it's a fawn response, think about replaying that moment in your head and what it would be like to say no. If the thought of saying no brings genuine fear or panic, that's the nervous system signaling, no, don't do it. It's not safe. Okay, it's not a value judgment. And fawning happens before our values have been really understood. So this is so automatic and so quick. So if you're terrified at the idea of saying no, it's probably fawning. How do I know if I'm fawning or just being nice? Best test is the body test. Like I mentioned earlier, if the idea of saying no fills you with dread and anxiety, chances are it's a fawn response. Genuine kindness leaves you feeling warm and connect. Sometimes tired, but maybe you're okay with that. Maybe genuinely, I genuinely love looking after my neighbor's dogs. And sometimes I can be tired because when I have three of them running around, the house is bonkers. But I genuinely love it. So it's different to feeling resentful and annoyed and then everything they do being frustrating. Fawning can leave you depleted, resentful, and often unsure why you said yes in the first place. Genuine generosity comes out of a place of a sense of choice. Fawning comes out of a sense of survival. Even when there's no actual threat, our body's perceiving it as threat. Another marker is who do you do it with? Fawning tends to spike around certain people. So you might not be like this with everybody. It might not be a response that gets activated in all scenarios with all people. It could be specific people, often authority figures or parents, you know, a boss, partners, anyone whose disapproval or anger feels disproportionately scary. If you can hold your ground amongst most people, but completely collapse around one or two, then that's information, okay? That tells you something about that dynamic and that relation. And the last thing to think about is how easy was it to remember what you actually wanted in that moment? Fawners often genuinely cannot recall their own preferences 5 minutes after they've actually abandoned it. Can fawning develop in adulthood or does it have to come from childhood? It usually starts in childhood, in environments where appeasing the people kept you safe. It can also be developed or deepened in adulthood through long-term exposure to unsafe relationships or environments. That can be things like abusive partners, controlling or volatile workplaces, chronically unstable family systems, caregiver roles where you're responsible for managing someone else's emotional state. The nervous system can learn this as a strategy at any age, if the conditions repeat themselves for long enough. It's also why some people leave difficult relationships and discover that they're now fawning in their next one. That pattern was reinforced, not created, in the last relationship. Cultural and systemic factors also play a part here. Marginalized groups often develop fawning as a survival strategy in response to systemic threat, not just individual relationships. And that's a really important thing to recognize there, that some people have to try to keep themselves safe at all costs, and fawning is a really helpful strategy to do that. And the last question I want to answer is, does fawning go away once you recognize it? I wish it was so easy. I wish that just knowing something meant that you could change it just like that. It's not that easy. It's just the first step. It's a hopeful question, and I honestly wish I could just say, sure, once you recognize that that's it, you can just undo it. The pattern lives within the nervous system, not just the thinking part of the brain. So you can't think your way out of this. It softens through repetition, through practice, through being honest and not being punished for it. Each small no that doesn't end a relationship is data for your body. Each small disagreement that gets met with curiosity instead of anger teaches your system something new. Over time, that response gets quieter and more manageable. Therapy that works somatically can be really helpful for this. So things like somatic experiencing, EMDR therapy, even internal family systems therapy, schema therapy can be really helpful. So there are certain therapeutic modalities that can be really helpful for trying to repair this pattern, to try and find new ways of communicating that don't cost you so much. It takes time. Often not weeks, usually years, but it absolutely can shift. The fawn response was protective. It made sense when you needed it. Letting go isn't betraying anything. It's outgrowing something that you no longer need. So this pattern was productive. It was there when you needed it. It kept you safe. It's the only way you could. You did your best. You're allowed to outgrow it. You don't owe anyone the version of yourself that can't say no. Small shifts in everyday moments are what changes this, not just one single brave conversation. Small steps, those low stakes environments, practice saying, let me get back to you, practice saying no, practice having an opinion on something, practice putting forward a movie suggestion or a restaurant suggestion. Practice, practice, practice. Practice makes progress. Sometimes the kindest people in the room are the ones with the deepest fawn response. They've learned to extend all that care outward and very little inward. You're allowed to turn some of that inward. You're allowed to care about you. Podcast outro. The fawn response is a pattern, not a personality. You built it for a reason and you can unbuild it with practice. Start small this week. Notice one moment where you say yes when you mean no and see if you can buy yourself 5 seconds before you answer. That's the whole practice. Thanks for listening. If this one resonated with you, share it with someone who might need it. Take care now.